Hello, friends, and welcome to Hello Friend. My name is Bethany Rutter, and today's friend is Dominic Falcaro. Dom is one of the people I've known for the longest in my life and is a vibrant and fun person. At the end of each episode, I ask that guest who they would like to hear me talk to. And in episode one, Michael Chapman requested I talk to Dom. So here he is. Oh, and as you're about to hear, he has an incredible voice. But first, how do we know each other?
So I was really hoping that you're going to ask this story because I think it's such a fun origin story.
Yes.
So we went to sort of sister, brother, whatever you call it, schools. And there was a production of Death of a Salesman. And you were, who were you cast as?
The main female character, Linda Loman.
Linda Loman. See, I feel bad for actually not knowing Willie. I could remember Willie Loman, but I couldn't remember Linda Loman.
It's patriarchy, innit?
Exactly, very much that. So yeah, you were Linda Loman. And I think I was just like a voiceless character. But I was there at one of the rehearsals, and they were rehearsing one of the scenes that didn't have Linda Loman in. And I was just sitting in the theatre seats kind of watching, and you came up to me, and you... I can't remember your exact words, but I think it was something along the lines of, because the guy who was playing Willie Loman was absolutely dreamy.
He was.
So dreamy. You can see him in a Roisin Murphy video for, I think, Overpowered.
Yeah, he's in that Overpowered video. But we can come back to him after the tale.
So Bethany sits down next to me and is just like, oh, he's so dreamy. After a second, I'm like, and I was actually processing this in my brain a bit as well, because I hadn't actually really come out to anyone at this point. I'd come out to a few of my close female friends, but at school it was very much like a kind of unspoken thing. So I think you were actually one of the first people that I was just like, I basically just responded saying, yeah, he is so dreamy. And you just sort of like took like a second to be like, oh, okay.
I see how it is.
Yeah. And then we had, and then we just kept chatting. And then since then we did like more plays together and like spent more time together. Ended up having like, as a result of you being in the school so regularly, we developed kind of like a big sort of mutual friendship circle.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of been fun and games since then.
And that was like 2004, maybe. So that's been a long old time.
Long time. I just turned 28 and I'm just like, how the hell did that happen?
Yeah, how has it been like kind of half of our lifetime?
Yeah. Oh
but my God,
that's
who knows?
So long. Yeah, amazing.
But yeah, we bonded over a mutual attraction to the dude who was playing my husband in the joint school production of Death of a Salesman. And yeah, wasn't he a great guy?
He was a really great guy. He was just so lovely and just like, just kind of the guy that kind of like was handsome and lovely enough, but not like intimidatingly so or like up themselves.
Totally.
And like you could tell that he like really loved acting as well. Like the fact that he was so good was very much part of the aphrodisiac.
Yes. And ahead of this episode, I looked him up. Googled him. Yeah. Where is he now? Okay, so his name is Oliver Seymour Marsh. If you're listening, which you absolutely will not be, because why would you be?
But if you are, hi.
He is now in a band called The Blue Jays, which is a rock and roll band, which I assume came out of the fact that he was in that Million Dollar Quartet play and played like Carl Perkins, I think.
Yeah, because I thought that he was in, what's that, is it Jersey Boys? I thought that he was in Jersey Boys.
It was like Jersey Boys, but not
Jersey Boys.
Because I love Jersey Boys, and obviously he was like a big teenage crush for me, so if he'd been in Jersey Boys, I would definitely have gone to see it.
I remember seeing that he was in a production of Aladdin a while ago, and I was just like, ooh.
Hello.
So
yeah, that was how we met. What I feel like I kind of didn't really understand or like appreciate at the time, like that you had some like ungreat experiences at school of like being queer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I missed that.
Well, no, I think what's kind of interesting is obviously we both had the experience of being at those schools and being queer, and I actually think your experience was kind of, in many ways, a lot worse because you were going out with someone who was at the school with you.
Yeah.
And also who was younger than you.
Yeah.
I think the year below.
Yeah.
And that was very much perceived within the school as like almost the way that they handled it, they almost were treating it like an abuse of power, which was absolutely not. Like, it's just bonkers. It's exactly the kind of like homophobic things that happen in schools. You know, they feel like oh, a relationship is happening. We need to kind of protect them from this. So I remember seeing like all of that play out and being kind of like absolutely horrified by it, and being kind of, for myself, for my own experiences of being queer at school, kind of grateful that they weren't as bad. I mean, what happened to me a lot was I was fortunate enough to be, essentially, I was one of the first boys in the school who had female friends.
So yeah.
I basically managed to get protected by a coterie of like cool, in inverted commas, people. I mean, some of them are still cool, but
like me.
Yeah. who essentially stopped it from being too bad, because I knew if they sort of came for me, my friends would stick up for me.
Your female friends, who they probably wanted to burn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't going to work out well for them if they ever wanted to get laid, and they definitely did.
Yep, being teenage boys.
And so I got shielded from a lot of the direct stuff, but what came out a few years later is apparently there was a lot of stuff happening behind my back that I wasn't aware of, and also in situations where there were people who were, basically when teachers would not stand up for me and would not protect me from anything. I remember there was a particularly bad incident in one of these Spanish lessons. I can't remember the name of the Spanish teacher, but he was an absolute dick. Can I swear?
Yes. This is not the radio.
Absolute fucking dick. There was a particularly bad incident with one of the boys who was basically just going on and on, like about just like every slur you could name, and just the teacher was just kind of like just sitting there. Rather than being like, you can't say that, you're going to, you're going to some sort of like authority, because luckily I had a lot of backing from the head of sixth form and that sort of thing, and a lot of people who actually got that I was going through a bit of a difficult time and helped me out a lot. But instead of doing that, he was just like, okay, we're moving on to the next part of the lesson. And this would be like a recurring thing. So
That's so wild.
Yeah.
That like this person that was specifically there to like help and protect you just didn't.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I think we had weirdly similar but different experiences around the same few years where like you got shit from like your fellow classmates and the teacher's involvement was kind of passive. But I really didn't get any shit from like my fellow students. Like I didn't experience any kind of homophobic bullying, but I did experience it from the staff who really, as you kind of alluded to earlier, really dealt very badly.
Extremely badly.
With my relationship. So I am born very late in the year, so I'm young for my year. The girl that I was with for quite a lot of my sixth form years is very old for her year, so we were actually only born a few weeks apart, but it meant that I was in the year above and she was in the year below.
Because also you were head girl as well, and they perceived that as like part of the problem, which is really hilariously weird, because you were head girl, because in your school, I believe head girl was basically like a vote, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like a popular vote.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how much people who are listening know Bethany, but she is like, she knows everyone. And you are like an excellent people person, so it's like no surprise to me that like you won, because you know people love you and you're great.
Yes, thank you. But yeah, that was almost like part of the problem, where like she was kind of very clever and she was kind of headed for Oxford and all of this stuff, and it was like they really saw me as this like threat to her future and treated me as such. And it was a really, like, strange and unsettling experience.
And this is actually a recurring thing, because I remember also there was a boy in my... a few years older than me, called Nicholas Uglow.
I remember him.
Yeah, who was, like, really eccentric, like, gay, but, like, was killing it in, like, loads of fields. Did loads of theatre, did loads of drama, and was basically, like, one of the top candidates to be head boy, and was not given it. And he basically said, I'm like 99% sure that the reason why I was taken out of the consideration is because I am out and I'm publicly out as gay. You know, they probably would, if I had just been eccentric, they might have just let me slide through. But because of that, I definitely didn't get it. He kicked off about it quite a bit. I think that there was a lot of kind of senior caginess around it. You know, I think that schools didn't want to be labelled like the gay school, almost.
Yeah.
Especially when, because I think a lot of it comes down to this idea of kind of visible queerness. Like, if you're visibly queer, people really react differently to if you're kind of like, got, if you've got that passing privilege. You know, I think we talk a lot about passing privilege as sort of a trans issue, and I think that it's so much more complicated than that.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it never really occurred to me to hide the fact that, like, we were in a relationship at school, because it was such a friendly place, and, like, I knew that I probably wasn't going to face any hostility from my peers. And so when I did face hostility from my teachers, that felt like a real kind of betrayal. And yeah, some of it was really bad. And, like, she wasn't out to her family. And that was often used as a bit of a bargaining chip by the staff. And, like, yeah, if you don't do this, then we'll have to, like, involve, you know, her family. And it was just a really, like, weirdly traumatic time that I think at the time I was just like, well, I have no power over this. And then with hindsight, like, I've grown increasingly upset and unhappy about how that went for me. And I feel like, I really don't know. But it was not a great first experience of, like, being queer in the world, even though, like, my friends and, like, other girls in my year and, like, in her year were very, like, chill about it. And, you know, it was, you know, fine from that point of view. Just the way that, like, a lot of the staff behaved towards us, and especially towards me, kind of treating me like I was this threat, throwing her off her course towards her brilliant shining future at Oxford, was, like, very uncomfortable. And yet, I think if it had happened to Bethany in her 20s, that would have gone differently. But it was kind of shit. So yeah, it's interesting that, like, we both had kind of shit experiences at school.
Well, what's really interesting to me as well is that actually I've lost contact and lost touch with a lot of the straight friends that I had at school at that period in time, because I've actually found that, like, weirdly, the homophobia has got worse since me not being around. Like, you know, I wasn't seeing them as much. You know, when I did, it would be more occasional, and I was spending a lot of my time in my life, you know, with my you know, a lot of my gay friends or queer friends, or, and I think that I think a lot of them maybe took it as a bit of a slight, and I found out that basically, like, rumours had been started about me. I've more or less applied the I do not want to be seen or
see or be seen by straight people
okay Cupid filter to my life.
Yeah,
you know, and that was kind of one of the reasons why, you know, obviously there are straight people who did not do that, did not engage in the rumor, who I would like to see, and, you know, have maybe fallen out of touch with, but certainly knowing that happened has made me very much be like, do you know what, that group of people there, I'm kind of done with you.
I don't need them.
Yeah,
well, I think that's totally fucking justifiable. And I'm sorry that we both had those experiences in our lives, you know, from various sources.
I think as queer people, you kind of, you do your best to not let it get to you, because it is, in this day and age, it's not so much the overt thing, it's the death of a thousand cuts. But the idea that you're not constantly experiencing it, like, especially being, I know for a fact that my eccentricity and stuff, when I was in a job that was more consumer facing, so it would have been one where I'd been just interacting more with kind of, like, basically I'd have been in charge of, like, getting money in, I think that was seen as, like, a volatile element, and I've seen that, like, negatively affect my career. Luckily, I've been able to make, like, smart choices and get along in different ways. I feel like career-wise, I'm actually doing really well for myself at the minute. But it is something that I'm aware of that does affect my life every day. And it's actually really nice to come here and, like, sort of discuss these things, because I think when you're doing a lot of this sort of stuff, you don't necessarily want to, like, bring your queer friends down, because we all know we're going through it. So it's actually nice to have, like, a forum where it's kind of specific,
appropriate to talk about it. Yeah. So you think that, like, being visibly queer has definitely had an impact on, like,
yeah.
the way your career has gone and the way that people have reacted to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a common thing that you'll have people telling you that you're gay before you really even know what gay is. Like,
yeah, that, oh my God, that is so true. That is so true. I remember, like, in primary school, I remember, like, my first primary school, which I must have left before I was about 9. Mm. I remember someone telling me that I was a lesbian and, like, that's wild. Yeah. I was literally like a child and like I have not turned out to be a lesbian, which is irrelevant. But like, yeah, that's so true.
Mm. Your nails are so great, by the way. I've literally just noticed them.
Thank you.
That's like my favorite color. I have a dress from Superdry that I just got from TK Maxx.
They're like a juicy pinky red and quite long and pointy.
Yeah.
But yeah, people are telling you you're gay before you even know what that means, let alone how it applies to you. You're so right.
And especially, you know, I think that that narrative is harmful on two fronts as well, because I think that there are a lot of people who, you know, aren't actually visibly gay, who I find have such a tortured relationship with their kind of sexuality, often gender identity, and kind of how they need to perform themselves. They have such a tortured relationship with that because of the fact that, you know, they have people telling them, oh, if you're gay, you're like this. And if you are gay and not like that, it's almost seen as like, oh, I'm not like them. Like, it's kind of this weird exceptionalism that, like, straight people love to do. It's just like, oh, I couldn't even tell you were gay. You know, things like that. And I think it actually really fucks up people's relationships with this idea that you can just, like, tell. I think it fucks it up a lot, especially when I think that there's a lot more now that people are kind of embracing more narratives. There are a lot of straight men who are kind of embracing their femininity. And I really like to see that because I think that straight men are just so screwed up. Like, I, obviously, like we all are, but I think that they are having a really rough time. And I think that's why we're seeing like the rise of things like MRA and things like that. And I see these like new narratives emerging of like feminine straight men and, you know, obviously sometimes it goes really fucking wrong, like sort of power bottom style. But, actually the more that we see these narratives emerging, like, I think that's really positive.
Yep. I think you're totally right.
And also kind of more women being okay with feminine men as well. I think that that's an interesting shift that has been happening as well.
I think you're right. I think you're totally right.
Because also, I think that we just got to be really... The only thing that I want to be really careful about that, though, is straight men getting excessive praise for really shit basic things. Like, I know a lot of... I don't care if this pisses people off. As much as I am very much in favour of, like, straight men kind of, like, changing kind of what is a straight man, I do think we have to be really wary of media narratives that are actually quite dumbed down. And reward straight men for things that aren't necessarily kind of a true reflection of any real change.
I think that is a very legitimate point. So I'd like to talk to you about your great passion, Cola Falcaro.
Yes.
So can you give me like a potted history of your drag life?
Yeah. So Cola Falcaro is actually my second drag name. I originally started as Victoria Station because coming from Croydon, I thought it was really funny to be like Victoria Station because I like the idea of just being like, yeah, everyone comes through me. And also I think that, like, I think dumb drag names are like absolutely the best. So Victoria Station was like a very stupid name. So I really enjoyed that. And I was going by that for a while and I wasn't actually really doing any drag. Like, I was sort of like, I was playing with it. I was trying things. I was going to house parties in costume. You know, it was very much the very early days. And it was sort of very much pre the Drag Race explosion. Like, now all the drag queens that I work with, we have TMDQ. TMDQ stands for Too Many Drag Queens. And it's what we use whenever there's like, it's like, oh, here comes another TMDQ. Not because we're not pleased. Like, the explosion of drag as a result of Drag Race has been fantastic for everyone's careers. And it's opened up so much more opportunity and it's revived like a lot of drag that was kind of like stumbling. And it's really helped out so many like venues as well. So not in any way trying to shit on that. But there really are just so many drag queens now. And do you know what? Like, maybe not everyone needs to be a drag queen. But anyway, so I started out as Victoria Station. And then one of my friends was starting out a new night at the Eagle in Vauxhall. This is when they were still doing all the like fetish parties and all that sort of stuff. And it was called Deep Fried. And they didn't necessarily have a lot of room at that moment in time, because it is sort of pre-drag race explosion, for drag performers in clubs. It was kind of seen as like a unique thing. You'd maybe have like performers, but you'd be much more likely to get like a boylesque act or something like that. So they hit me up about that and were like, hey, do you want to just do this? And I was just like, yeah, like, let's do it. Like, I was so excited about the idea, and I like cut together tracks really badly, having no idea what I was doing. Like, I did not know what the normalized function was, so I literally went up to the DJ booth with a piece of paper that said, okay, this is the point where you need to turn up the track.
Yeah.
This is the point where you need to turn down the track. And it was, like, so shonky. But then I actually turned out to be, like, a relative success. So we did another one, and then one of the guys that we were doing it with, a guy called Talkshaw, who's, like, super sexy, wonderful, now is a game developer, ended up moving. So we were like, we're not really going to do it anymore, because it was a kind of an electro-themed night. And the two DJs were Rob Holly and Talk, and Rob is very much like a pop music DJ. So at the same time, Rob was doing a night at the RVT called Push the Button. And so when Deep Fried kind of closed down, it was very important to Rob to kind of keep it, like, keep drag queens going and just kind of make sure that spaces are, like, visibly, you know, queer, and kind of counteracting some of that mask for mask kind of thing that was, like, extremely bad at the time. Like, I think Drag Race and, you know, making drag cool actually made femininity a lot cooler within the gay scene as well. So it really actually helped that. At the time, it was, like, a particularly, almost, like, peak toxic, because I think also, like, the apps had, like, started up. Like, we were an early grinder at that point as well. Could be, like, an oral history of everything. God.
It's very interesting.
And so, like, toxic kind of mask-for-mask culture was very there. So Rob really wanted to try and, like, keep a bit of, you know, weirdness and a bit more queerness to it. So I ended up continuing along and doing Push the Button there.
And at this point, you were still Victoria Station.
No, so actually, Rob renamed me because he didn't know my drag name for the posters for Deep Fried. So he just put me down as Cola. So I was just like, okay, well, I guess I'm Cola now, because that was the only thing that I'd done that actually people had cared about. So I did that. And I just tacked on my own surname, which is Falcaro, but I changed it to a PH to try and make it slightly less Googleable if my parents were searching. They know about the drag now, so yeah. It's fine. But at the time, I cared, and I figured I've got a really flouncy surname anyway. So it kind of worked. So basically then through Rob and Push the Button, I kind of just like started networking, meeting more people. And also all my friends were kind of aware of the fact that I was doing drag. And at the time, there wasn't TMDQ. So I was starting to get lots more kind of little random things, like a music video shoot and just other like really, really random things. I just kept doing all those things and eventually just kind of built up a network. And now, you know, I've got to be able to do some really cool things. Like, you know, I've just come back from, I think, either my fifth or my fourth Glastonbury performing. And I've been able to do, like, we still do Push the Button every month. It's the last Friday of every month. And I do basically all the performance for that. So if you ever want to come see me, come to the Royal Vauxhall Tavern on the last Friday of every month. I've also, like, in July, I'm going to be doing a show called Acronyms Are Gay at Yo Sissy.
That's a great name.
Yeah, it's all about like kind of like queer language. Like it's kind of like a deliberately stupid, provocative title, but it is more about how we shape, you know, language as queer people. And I've been able to do things like I performed at Low Stakes, which was a performance art festival, and that was kind of the blueprint for now what is being developed into a full 45-minute show. Which is all about kind of the weirdness that happened in my childhood, where they basically tried to turn my sister into a pop star. But obviously it's not actually about like them doing that, because that's like my sister's story and I don't want to tell that. I wanted to tell the story about like how that affected me and kind of the idea of the psychology behind kind of maybe obviously feeling that you're not the favourite child, and how I think a lot of that kind of drove me ultimately into drag. And it's this idea of kind of a pop star is a lot closer to a drag queen than a real human woman. And that's sort of what put the initial kind of desire into me to like perform and like be kind of like seen. Cause I think at the time I felt very unseen. So yeah, if you want to come see that, just follow me on Twitter. I'll be posting up dates for that soon. It's one of the few things that I want to do before I'm no longer fun employed. I want to get that totally finished, but hopefully be touring that.
And who are you on Twitter? People can't follow if they don't know where to find you.
That's true. My Twitter handle is at E-R-R-O-R-F-I-E-D, which is like a very long-standing handle that I've
had. That's been your name forever?
Forever.
Since I've known you, I feel like any place you've existed on the internet, you have been errified.
Yes.
Even on LiveJournal, right?
Yeah, even on LiveJournal. And also, like, find me on Instagram, find me on Facebook if you want. I'm pretty free with the, like, friend requests. But also, the Twitter name, you'll know you got the right one because the Twitter name is Papillon Outcomes.
Yes. Yeah, that's me. So, something that I have wanted to, like, talk to you about for ages, but I feel like I haven't seen you for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe longer than we would think.
But I think that's the kind of the lovely thing about Twitter is that you still keep conversing with people, like, even if you're not necessarily seeing them, you kind of know what's going on in their life and stuff. So even if you aren't seeing them, you're getting like updates and stuff so that when you do finally see them, it's not like you're kind of catching up in this kind of like weird way and
been
around for ages. You've kind of been keeping up. So
So the topic is makeup.
Yes.
Love makeup. So, talk me through your fave items for your cola looks. What do you think are some, like, hidden gems that maybe, like, the general populace outside of the drag world could benefit from? Tips and tricks that you think that, like, would help your average people on the street?
Okay, so, first things first, I think people...
You can't say that and not say first things first, I'll eat your brains.
First things first, I'll eat your brains. That's not necessarily a makeup tip, but just a recommendation.
Just
for
FYI.
Life. Yeah. No, I've had a pretty heavy Glastonbury, I might. but yeah, so first of all, I really think don't sleep on stage makeup. Stage makeup is a lot cheaper than a lot of your high-end brands, but it has the same level of performance. There are lots of great stage makeup shops. I only know ones in London, I'm afraid. But certainly in London, Charles Fox is fantastic.
Is that the one in, is that the Covent Garden one?
Exactly,
is that still there?
Yep.
Next to Tatty Divine?
Yep.
Oh, cool.
It's not next to Tatty Divine. You're thinking of Screenface.
I was thinking of Screenface. Did that close down?
So that's closed down, but now they've reopened in Old Street, which is going to be the other one that I've named. There's a particular brand called Krylan, and because it's ultimately, it's makeup for theatre. What's great is you can go in there. The sales assistants know a lot. It's a really good thing to do if, for example, You know exactly what you want, but you don't know who sells it, and you don't know how much it's going to cost, you know, all that sort of stuff. You can go in there, and they pretty much will always have it.
And so, you can say, like, I want it to do this, I need it to last this amount of time, I need it to be waterproof,
exactly.
I need... Okay,
yeah,
cool.
People are really, really good in there. The next thing is, I would say, don't be afraid of powder, I think, or cream foundation, or basically, don't be afraid of unusual textures in makeup. So I think that there's a really heavy reliance, generally, on liquid foundations, and I don't think that is good, basically. A lot of high-end brands have started coming out with stick foundations recently, things like Hourglass. I know that Lancome have got one.
The Makeup Forever one is really nice.
Yeah, and really, I think that people sleep on stick foundations too much. Obviously, it's for very full coverage, but I think it's great. You know, blend it with a wet beauty blender. You can actually get loads of different levels of coverage with it. Don't sleep on powders. I think that people, again, are afraid of looking kind of too powdery.
And like cakey and chalky.
Exactly. And I think if you've applied your makeup properly, then that shouldn't be an issue. But also, getting on to the next one is then setting sprays. So I think there's this really common thing of setting sprays. And everyone uses setting sprays that have a pump action. And that's just wrong. Like, think about it just from a science point of view. A pump action is just going to do a bunch of individual droplets. It's just going to set a bunch of individual little points on your face.
This is so
true. Only use an aerosol setting spray.
Oh my God, this is the kind of shit that I need to hear.
So again, Krylan have got a matte one, an ultra matte finish, and they've also got a sort of dewy finish setting spray. Both you can get in aerosol format, and they're fantastic. And what's really good, again, if you are feeling slightly powdery, you can literally take your whole face with one of these and it just sort of sets it and just blends it all and just makes you look either dewy or matte again, with no kind of powdery chalkiness. So that's a real good one. And I've The setting sprays are so good. I have literally gone into a jacuzzi in full drag. I've held my head underwater, romped around in the jacuzzi for hours with like my eyebrows glued down and not a single thing moved. Obviously, okay. If I had like dragged my hand across my face, it probably would have. But the fact that it didn't with me like sloshing around there is bonkers. So really highly recommend getting a setting spray that is an aerosol.
Do you remember which brand it was on the jacuzzi experience?
So that was the Kryolan Ultra Matte.
Kryolan Ultra Matte. Okay, cool.
Those are my main tips. But also, please feel free to hit me up on Twitter anytime about makeup tips because I'm
and
more
where
than
to
happy
find
to
stuff
them.
And yeah. Yeah. Good. I'm very happy for you that you are starting a new job soon.
Yes.
Because I know that you were not loving life. And I think that like it is important to acknowledge that work is a four-letter word and can ruin your life. Mm. And, you know, maybe you know that better than anyone or as well as anyone.
Yeah, I think the main thing that I really learned from my experience, so I, you know, have had mental health problems in the past and, you know, that basically the job that I was in basically caused them to resurface in quite a violent way and very much affected my performance and was not particularly well handled by the company involved. What basically I took out of the whole experience is, first of all, if you are in a tough situation that you maybe aren't able to get out of, try and get on those antidepressants or something. Speak to your doctor because they're going to really be able to recommend something that maybe is just going to take off the edge enough to help you cope with an unpleasant situation.
So, and like get out of bed in the morning and
exactly.
March towards work.
Exactly. So really try and find something to get the edge off. The other thing is it's really important to acknowledge that I think we have this idea that mental health care is kind of a thing in and of itself. And actually, I totally disagree. I think, you know, the reason why there are higher rates of kind of like mental health problems in, you know, say, for example, poorer areas or, you know, poorer people have them more often is because your life is harder. And so, of course, it like takes a bigger toll on you. And so in the long term, always be trying to like try and find ways to make those steps, to make the long term changes better so that you can perform better. Because I know so many people who, you know, have got like quite severe mental health problems that are actually doing absolutely fine because they've been able to find ways to make it work for them and to find a life that doesn't cause their problems to flare up. So if you're in a situation where you're having the specific mental health problems to you flare up, do try and like take the steps, like speak to people, you know, speak to people who, you know, maybe work in different fields or just try and find ways to like slowly get yourself out of there if you can, because if you know, so often you know that like actually this mental health problem, it's not, obviously it's something that I have, but it is being exacerbated by my life circumstances. So get something to get the edge off and then figure out a plan for getting out there. That was my kind of my experience and what I would sort of really highly recommend if you're having a similar experience.
And it's just amazing like how many people, the aggravating factor in their mental health 9 times out of 10 I think is their work. Mm. And I hate that like that is such a real thing and work dictates whether you have money or not. Mm. And you can't live without having money. Mm. And you're just like tied into this like bullshit experience that's ruining your life and you can't opt out of. Mm. Or you can't like fully opt out of, you just have to find ways of mitigating it. Mm. And obviously some companies deal with shit better than others, but like it breaks my heart how many people I know who just have their lives ruined by their jobs.
And I think also being, you know, millennials and all that, it means, you know, so many of us, because of the fact that, you know, we're not being paid properly, a lot of us have side hustles.
Yeah.
So we're not just working on a job. You know, I've been doing drag at this point for like 5 years and I had a rough think about how much money I've brought in over time. And actually it's helped me so much.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I often forget that actually, you know, it does make a difference. So if lots of people are doing side hustles and a main job, of course people are burning out. Of course people are finding it tough. Because if that's what you have to do to bring in the money so that you can survive, it's impossible. And I think that when people, you know, that's what really pissed me off about that. What was that advert? I think it was like HP came out with an advert that was just like, oh, I've got like 27 jobs.
Yeah, it's so
fabulous. And it's just like, I mean, obviously it's great if you have passions and you're following them and you're getting to do them. But like, if you are spending your entire life dedicated to work, especially because I think downtime is so important, even if you're enjoying yourself, if you don't get downtime, something's gonna like collapse at some point.
It's an unsustainable lifestyle for the long term.
Mm.
Yeah, because sometimes I'm like, oh my God, I have so much stuff to do. I'm so busy, but I know I never feel like it's ruining my life. Mm. Like all of the stuff that I have in my life that I'm electing to do is very much like I'm choosing to do it because I'm passionate about it. Mm. So I feel like I'm relatively on top of that. But if I wasn't choosing to add all these elements, like doing this podcast or like doing extra freelance writing or whatever, if I wasn't choosing to do those, it would be such a different thing because I'd have to work to someone else's schedule. I'd be working to someone else's standards with like their money impositions on me and stuff like that. And it really changes things. Doing things in exchange for money really changes the nature of the thing that you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my take.
Well, no, I mean, because also, like, so whenever I have job interviews, you know, I don't hide the fact that I do drag because I actually think it's an asset, you know. It gives me loads of, like, creative inspiration to pull on and bring into my work. And also, I wouldn't want to work anywhere where I know it's a problem.
Yep.
And so often the question comes up, it's like, oh, well, you're, like, producing this or you're doing this. How do we know that you're not just suddenly going to leave and do that full time? And I think that actually, you know, what is quite nice is that I kind of use my main job to make sure that I can choose, I can pick and choose the projects that I want to do with drag. So it means that I'm not there taking the shit gig, kind of doing someone's makeup for a hen do or like taking someone along on their hen do. And oh, don't get me wrong, some of those gigs are really fun. Some of them are absolute hell. And being able to say no to things is a luxury.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like it would take so much of the joy out of my drag. Like, I love doing drag. Like, even, like, at Glastonbury, I was in drag for, like, 4 days on the trot, and I've got, like, a massive welt on my lip from having to shave every day.
I can't see it. All I'm saying is I cannot see this welt, but...
Well, it's... I can see it, like, just don't come close.
Okay.
but I did drag every single day, even though I was absolutely exhausted, because I fucking loved it. I loved, like, marching around and, like, feeling my oats and being on stage and dancing and just, like, being on the microphone and, like, shouting at straight people and being like, you all suck, like, whatever. Not necessarily that, but I, you know, defending the queer space and making sure people are aware that kind of, like, yeah, you're welcome, but this is the priority.
And it's fun because you are doing it on your own terms.
Yeah.
Like, this is a part of your life that, like, is not really beholden to anyone else. Like, obviously, yeah, with, like, Glastonbury stuff, you're working in collaboration with other people, but it's not, like, your full-time job where you rely on like playing by the rules and like if you don't do it this way you're not going to get money, you're going to get sacked. Like, money does change everything.
It really does. And it's that's also why it's so nice to, when you do have like side hustles and stuff, you find people that you enjoy working with and you just continue to do so. Like, I've really enjoyed doing like all of the shows at Push a Button because, you know, Rob is such a great collaborator, because I basically say to him, I want to do this, like, can I have like maybe a bit of extra money so I can do this, or are you okay with this like idea? And the answer is never, or very rarely, like no, or at worst it'll be like, let's find a way to make this happen. And it's for like really stupid stuff. Like, we had a Brittany and Christy, it was a Brittany night, and as the performance, what I had decided is that I wanted to do, it was a Brittany Christina battle to the death.
Yep.
It's actually quite a horrendous story if I take it through the whole thing. So do you want me to?
I don't know if we have time.
Fine.
But
basically, like, the short version is that I then later that day woke up in a park covered in ants in full drag, clutching an inflatable mattress, being shouted at by a strange old man like, get out of the park. And I was so confused.
Okay, I'm really glad we didn't get the long version, because I just like hearing the ending with no context. Well, we have come to the end of our time together, so I'm going to end with a few questions. Mm-hmm. Number one, what is your favourite song to lip sync to?
Oh, shit. So I often like combine songs. Like, genuinely, my favourite song... Oh, actually, I know the song that I haven't done a lip sync to yet that I would really like to, which is Let Me Know by Roisin Murphy.
Yep, banger.
It's such a banger. But I'm really at the moment enjoying like my new kind of performance style, which is basically like comedic PowerPoint. Because like it's basically uniting the two skills that I really like I'm confident in life, which is I make really good PowerPoints and I'm pretty good at drag. So I'm just like mashing them together at the moment and doing all these like weird shows that come with a PowerPoint.
That is great. I'm very happy that you are combining your two great passions. If you went to the shop to buy crisps, what crisp would you buy?
I always try and buy a meat-flavoured McCoy's
because
I'm
steak.
A vegetarian. But all of the McCoy's meat-flavoured crisps are vegetarian anyway, so it's my little, like, cheeky moment.
That is a great cheeky moment. What emoji best describes you?
It'll be, like, one of the fireworks celebration emojis, because I try and be, like, as, like, positive as possible at, like, all times. Like, even if I'm having, like, quite a rough time, I try and, like, see the positive, because I find that, like, I'm a bit better at coping with, like, when things are shit than other people, so I try and use that to try and, like, lift other people up a bit. So I've decided that one.
A fireworks emoji. Mm. And finally, is there anyone that you would like me to talk to that you can think of?
I would love to have Jude in London on the podcast.
Rude Jude, I love her so much.
So good on Twitter.
You're right. Okay, cool.
Also, I absolutely adore Finn Balm.
Oh,
the
Martin.
Lovely, sexy Martin.
This is like the second time we've talked about Martin on this show because he's just so cute. And I was tweeting him only this morning. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's
so you
really
are
lovely.
To be found at Errified on twitter.com.
Yes.
Dominic Falcaro. Elsewhere on the internet.
Yes, and also at the RVT, the last Friday of every month. And I'll kind of always be announcing things that I'm doing on Twitter. So if you ever want to come see me, do one of my weird PowerPoints or do one of my weird shows. Like recently, I decided to make a new version of The Last Supper. So I just got like a group of people together and we just recreated it, but like we recontextualized it. And it's like, this is the first queer supper. Like stupid shit like that. Come say hi.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And thank you listening so much for joining me again after last week's mid-season break. This will be a 10-episode series, so there are only a few more weeks left. If you have any thoughts, comments, or suggestions, please email me at hellofriendpod@gmail.com and I'll get back to you. See you next time.
Bye.